Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is Southern Californian writing activist Carla Rachel Sammoth. In her work, she's taught creative writing to incarcerated youths in the California penal system, taught at the Los Angeles Writing Project at Cal State in Los Angeles, and was an LA community teaching artist for PEN America. In her new memoir, she tells her own story of living as a lesbian Jewish single mother raising a black son in Southern California. One Day on the Gold Line tells her story in essay form with interesting observations on race, culture, family, and sexuality. From an opening essay that describes her change of heart on having children while escaping from a burning ferry boat crossing the Mediterranean, to her title essay, which tells the story of her assault perpetrated by Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies while riding home on the LA Metro, to stories on helping her son overcome substance abuse, her essays offer thought-provoking ideas about contemporary life in 21st century America. The name of her book is titled One Day on the Gold Line, a memoir and essays. And Carla Rachel Sammoth is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Carla Sammoth, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
In your collection of memoir essays, One Day on the Gold Line, these essays reflect on a lot of contemporary issues of race, class, culture, sexuality, family. I was wondering, was that the intention in writing it, or was it simply a telling of the stories of your life?
You know, I think the idea originally began years ago when I was working on a shorter piece writing about having had a lot of miscarriages, and one miscarriage in particular that took place during the Northridge earthquake. And the author who was working with me on that essay in the workshop said, you know, I don't usually say this, but I think that you should be writing more of a book-length memoir. And that was really intimidating. So she said, you know, you can also write linked essays. And that kind of planted the seed. And then that began to grow with the idea of having essays that form a whole. So it's not exactly the same as a straight essay collection because they form a whole story. And so the idea was there is a story arc. I did want to cover a lot of those issues because I kind of wrote the book that I wanted to read that had families like mine, you know, so queer, African-American, Jewish, blended family, single parent. I wanted to see more of those stories. And then in dealing with some of the issues around, like you said, race and class and identity and police violence and ultimately with addiction, again, reading memoirs by people who were experiencing some of these things was kind of a lifeline for me when I was struggling, when my son was struggling with addiction. And I really needed that connection. So that was kind of my goal, was to be able to write a book that spoke to a number of different people dealing with these issues, you know, including things like trying to have a child, really, and finding it much more difficult than originally thought. I mean, I think I originally thought when the time came, I could sort of check in and have a child, and it proved to be, you know, I lost many pregnancies. And so the memoir is really about that difficult journey to having a son, and also the myth that I believe about creating safe sanctuary for the family. You know, and thinking that having this family composed, having a lesbian mom, being African-American Jewish, being part of a blended family, or even with a single mom, that it would just make life richer for my son. But the reality was much, much harder. So it is kind of contemporary parenthood. It is, I like to say, it's a bit of a Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. I don't know if people are Disneyland reference. A bit of a roller coaster. I said that to someone the other day who was from, I think, South Carolina, and they said, I don't really know what you're talking about. Is that a children's book?
Yeah. Right. Well, I remember Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. But as you're saying that, it sort of reminds me of the old Russian proverb, and I think it's either Tolstoy or Chekhov said it. So, you know, happy families are all the same. Unhappy families are all unique in their own way. I'm paraphrasing. And I'm not saying your family was unhappy, but it was certainly unusual.
It was. You know, I did want to see a cartoon that said adult children of normal parents or adult children of normal families, and it was one kid sitting alone in a big auditorium. So, you know, I think there's more families that look like ours. My friend used to say to me, you know, if you just moved to like the East Bay, Oakland, your son would just be one of many Afro Jews with a lesbian mom. But Yeah, but you know, it actually turned out to be growing up in the middle of the anti-gay culture wars was really brutal for my son. So, you know, when he was in maybe first, second grade, I did tell him that I was a lesbian. You know, I'd always told him that, you know, there could be two moms or two dads. But when I told him I was a lesbian, he said it didn't really count until I had a girlfriend. So then when I finally met someone who he met and he liked, and he met the daughter who was close to his age, he could not wait to tell everyone once we said it was serious about, I'm going to have a new sister, I'm going to have another mom. And it turned out to be not so great, this being biracial, having two moms, a blended family, because he began to be told things like, don't take that to school, you know, or you're not really black, look in the mirror. And his experience in school kind of mirrored that of the nation, because that was during the culture wars. I remember him asking me something like, if John Kerry supports gay people, just kind of dating how long ago this was, then why does he not support gay marriage? And trying to explain, you know, we tried to show a film at his school called That's a Family. That was a very sweet film. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's older now. It has like a single parent family. It has a biracial family. It has parents who adopt it. It has, you know, all these different families. And the school ended up pulling it, even though it was a liberal kind of progressive school. They felt like there were parents who complained about seeing that.
It's really amazing. Thinking back 10 years and how different society is, even just 10 years or 15 years, it's pretty amazing.
Oh, my
amazing.
Gosh, it is incredible. I mean, it definitely changed. As he got older, he got a group of friends that were very multiracial. The Arabic student there gave all the Jewish kids a Valentine that said, I love Jew. and then he started telling me, you know, Mom, why wouldn't I want a lesbian mom by high school? We can look at girls together. And he actually posted on Facebook. He started, posting things like, you know, if you're a homophobe, just come right out and tell people, put an H on your forehead. And, you know, things changed. Younger people, at least in urban area, you know, I'd be interested to hear how it is out where you're at, but it became more common for kids to be along the spectrum, too, in terms of not along the gender, sexual preference.
Yes.
And not have to define themselves. So he was able to tell me at a certain point, Mom, you know, I just have to tell you, he likes percentages. I think I'm 90% straight, but I just imagine Ryan Gosling with those muscular tattooed arms wrapped around me and maybe. So he definitely has a good sense of humor.
He does.
Raphael, yeah, that sort of kept us going, kind of music and humor over the years.
In the early essays, you know, he is such a anchoring presence for you in your life, at least the way you write it, at a very young age. And so when he does develop substance abuse issues in his teenage years, I was so saddened because he seems like he was such a rock for you at a very uncertain time in your life.
He really was. You know, before he started using drugs, when we our family had unblended, and it was so much different than the kind of happy chaos that I imagined, you know, with a couple kids, a couple of dogs, a leopard gecko named Michael Jordan. You know, so our family had blended. We'd had to move out of the big house that I'd pulled money out of my house to remodel, where we were all going to live together. Big, beautiful Spanish-style house with bright colors. And most of all, we were separated from my stepdaughter, who I was very close to, and who he was very close to, his stepsister. And he hit a point where he said, you know, Mom, I'm going to do the cooking now. I guess he wasn't satisfied with my cooking. I was, you know, this multitasking single mom and probably went to Trader Joe's too often, you know. Anyway, so he starts doing the cooking and created a huge mess, but cooked wonderful things. He would look them up on YouTube, like how you remove a membrane to make ribs. And one time, and my job was cleaning up and putting on music. So one time he said, I'm going to make these banana nut muffins. And he did this tributary of, oh my gosh, melted butter, brown sugar, cinnamon. And they were amazing. I remember those muffins coming out and thinking, you know, and we were playing, I think, Here Comes the Sun, something like that, thinking like, okay, so if it's my son, you know, that's enough. This is good. This works. Even if it isn't the big blended happy chaos family.
I think
yes, he was a rock.
Yeah. And I think this is an interesting part because we hear so much about blended families. Your story is about blending a family and then having to unblend a family. That's something you don't ever read about.
No, and you know, I was quite arrogant in the beginning. I'd hear people talking about, oh, you know, blended families can be difficult. It's like, oh, what are you talking about? You know, this is easy, you know, we all get along great. he was going to a private school that was really majority white at the time, and they were trying to show that they were actually more diverse than people thought, so they asked families to take family photos. And we took one that had his stepmom, his stepsister, me, my son, and his dad in front of the Jackie and Mac Robinson statues in the Pasadena City Hall. And it just looked like, okay, we gave that school something. They were able to say, okay, these are some of our typical students. You know, it wasn't true, of course, at all. But yeah, I mean, it was actually much harder than I anticipated. I always felt like the more the merrier, and that my son and I were kind of like that, pretty social beings. But it proved to be much more difficult. The person I married in the second marriage had a lot of issues with men and consequently with boys, and just a lot of challenges around anger and how she expressed it. And it became very difficult to the point of where my son, one time after she had blown up again at him, said he had gone to see a film at the Museum of Tolerance, and they were talking about the Holocaust, and they were saying, we say never again, but now there's Darfur. And he came home and told me that story. He said, you know, she's just like that movie. She says never again. She'll never get upset like that again, and that it happens. So it was a really hard decision to unblend that family, because we were very, very close to my stepdaughter. We bonded, and she started calling me mom from a really very soon after we met. And my son loved having a sibling. So, yeah, it was difficult. Now when someone talks about stepchildren and blended families, I just am so impressed when things go smoothly.
My guest today is Carla Rachel Samuth. She teaches at Los Angeles, a writing project at Cal State Los Angeles, and is the author of One Day on the Gold Line, a memoir in essays. I want to ask about the first essay in the story, which you tell of an event many writers could get a whole book out of. It was escaping a burning ferry boat in the Mediterranean, but this was just a sort of a jumping off point for your own story. And in many ways, as I read more of the essays, I said, oh, this seems somewhat metaphoric.
So you caught that. Yay.
Tell us a little bit about the decision to include that, since it really wasn't, it was only metaphorically important, I think.
The reason why I found it to be important was, and I'll just sort of talk a little bit about it, if I may. I got on a ship going from Bari, Italy, to Greece, and I had just split up with someone I was engaged to. I had had to terminate a pregnancy because of some health issues, and I was pretty heartbroken, and I was sort of like, I'm going to go off and see if I can recuperate, and go to Europe, maybe go to Greece and Israel. And was woken up in the middle of the night, and not really apparent what was wrong. It turns out there was an engine fire, but the Greek sailors were lowering the lifeboats and looking like they had never done this before. And the happy scene on the deck the night before of families and dogs and children was just complete chaos then. And, you know, so they loaded the women and the children and the dogs onto the lifeboats, and they kept some of the men on the ship. And everyone on my lifeboat, it was the middle of the night, the middle of the Mediterranean, pretty much everyone thought this is it. Everyone was crying except for two people. Me, I was not crying, and a woman who was comforting her baby. And I looked at the woman rocking her baby, and I had been thinking, well, it's maybe as good a time to go as any. And I looked at the baby, and I was, you know, if I were to die right then, my biggest regret would be never having had a child. And I started to cry. And then, you know, spoiler alert, I was saved. The ship came along. We were rescued. But so the jumping off point really has to do with, you know, I used to tease my son and say, I got off a burning boat to have you. But the jumping off point from the ship was really going back and saying, you know, this is something. I had lived a pretty full life already at 30, 31, but I had not had a child. And I knew that I really wanted that in my lifetime. So I guess that's the connection. And the metaphorical piece.
Exactly. Yeah, the metaphoric piece of it is this sort of near miss, you know, and there's been a variety of near misses in your life. And you've come out all right.
Yes. I mean, I definitely don't tie everything up neatly and sail off into the sunset. But you're right. Things do, there are a lot of wonderful things in my life to be grateful for, and things I do manage to survive. But there are many times in the book where you might wonder, or a reader might wonder, or even towards the end, you know, what's next? How is this all going to play out?
I have to ask about the title essay, One Day on the Gold Line. This is a horrendous episode in your life, and it's one day riding the Los Angeles Metro when you're accosted by a bunch of L.A. County deputies and basically taken down, shook down, beaten down because you couldn't produce your Metro pass quick enough.
Right, yeah. That was one of the times where I thought, I think I'd hit the bottom, and, you know, and then of course the bottom always changes. But I'd been going, our family had unblended. It was, I think, the middle of the recession. There was a lot going on that was difficult in my life financially and family-wise. And I'd been working on a piece writing about what it's like to raise a black son in the world we live in today. What my fears were is I saw him getting taller, and a series of incidents began to happen to him because of him being black. And I think we talked about this earlier when I taught incarcerated youth. At one point, I walk in and I see a room full of young black and brown kids that look just like him. So what I feared of him possibly being a victim of police violence was that much more complex after this happened to me. I was taken off the Metro because I couldn't immediately find my pass. I found a receipt, and I was searched and very invasively. And when I said, ouch, I was pressed into a pole, a cement pillar, and my nose was broken. And it was surreal. It became more real because I saw a video later that someone had shot immediately after when they were interviewing me. That is, a supervising deputy was interviewing me. And there was a huge puddle of blood next to me, and I had written about it and described a puddle of blood, but I felt really bad when I saw that video. Almost, you know, I might sound like I'm disassociated. I thought, a poor woman, you know. And I only found out later, I don't know how much of this news gets out to you guys, but a huge problem with the LA Sheriff's Department. There was a federal investigation. The sheriff and the deputy sheriff were all taken down and charged, and now there continues to be news. The issue then was that the sheriffs were trained in this culture of violence in the jails, and then their first assignment out was the Metro. And so once I started talking to civil rights attorneys after this happened to me, they began to tell me, well, no, there are problems going on with the sheriff's department. And there was just a big article yesterday about cliques, sort of gangs within the sheriff's department. So I did write a cover story about that, and I had an amazing number of people of every ethnicity, race, economic class, homeless people, you know, more middle class, come up to me and talk about their experiences that they had had. So I think that gave me a taste of what it's like to really write about something deeply personal and speak out. And you know, mostly people were appalled and very supportive, but, you know, there's always internet trolls as well.
Well, one of the things that came out was how dehumanizing this whole episode was from your very first encounter with them. And we always hear about this in regards to race and ethnicity. This case, it's more an incident over class. By riding the Metro in and of itself, they're making assumptions about who you are and what you're doing there that is a very sad thing for our society.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I had a dentist who saw, because I had also had a chipped tooth, and said, oh, you know, you look so Middle Eastern. That's probably what was going on at the time, you know. But I think you actually, that's a really accurate description, what you said, that the sheriffs, especially coming out of the jail, did not really see civilians, and probably particularly people riding the Metro or whoever they were in charge of, whether it was the jails or the Metro, as being fully human and, you know, treated people much differently. And you're right. When I was incarcerated in the jail section of the hospital, it was really frightening. You saw how you could sort of disappear if you didn't, you know, be quiet and follow directions. And there was a long period. I just remember being put in a room in terrible pain, bleeding, and there was just one sign on the wall that said, you have the right to ask for pain medication. But when I was crying, eventually somebody, a nurse or someone, came in and did say, you know, you need to be quiet or no one's going to help you.
Wow.
Yeah, it was definitely something that I won't forget. And it kind of just increased the fears I had for my son and the risks of being a young Black man today with law enforcement.
Well, that leads into a section of the book where you talk about giving the talk. I mean, the talk is something well known in a lot of, you know, African-American communities and Hispanic communities and any community that can be persecuted by law enforcement. But it's another thing for a lesbian Jewish mother to give that talk to her son. What was that experience like?
You know, it's funny, I had this conversation on another interview, and it's a balance because you want so much to tell your kid that they can do anything. You know, you don't want to kill their spirit and their, you don't want to, their openness to the world. On the other hand, you want them to know. You want to give the talk. You want them to know what happens if you're stopped by police. What are the do's and don'ts? And in talking about racism and police violence and classism, you know, how do you talk about those things and still let a person have a realistic idea of what the world is like, and at the same time still believe that they can do a lot in the world? And so it was kind of a delicate balance. And I remember, I think I write about that, but some years into where there was just murder after murder of young Black men, my son had just started driving, and he hadn't yet changed the license plates from his grandma's car, out-of-state license plates. And my wife was very worried, as well, that you got to talk to him. You know, he's young, he's Black, he's a new driver, and he's driving a car without a state license plate. And that's just a prescription for being pulled over. And so, yeah, I mean, I think I referenced in the book something I heard on one NPR station about the talk, where a family was talking about police violence, and their four-year-old overheard it and said, "Do I need to be wearing a bulletproof vest?"
Wow.
It's really a lot. So
I have to ask about another essay in the collection. Your son, Raphael, eventually developed some substance abuse issues in his teenage years. And again, I reference the fact of the way he was younger. And of course, he sounds like he's still a great kid today. But mm-hmm. You write an essay that gives us an unusual look at your experiences as a parent at that time. And it's titled "What to Expect When You're Expecting," a very typical title that parents have probably read at one point or another, the teenage years. And I was really struck by the number of ways a child can find a substance around the house that can give that child a buzz.
Yeah, you really don't, you know, you think, oh, I remember this from when I was young. You know, you really, there are so many things I remember early on and saying, wow, he really likes whipped cream, you know. I thought I just bought some whipped cream. I'm going to have to go out and buy more. And it really took me a while to the point of where he couldn't really get his hands on sort of pills or other kinds of drugs and started to still large amounts of Robitussin.
I'm so sorry.
And it was hard to find that out initially. It didn't necessarily show up in a drug test. And when that became apparent, it was really just so devastating. Just the idea that someone wanted relief so much. Because at that point, he wasn't using recreationally so much as, you know, by himself and probably trying to deal with a lot of anxiety, and would take 80 to 100 Robitussin. And so I had a lot of time going in and out of ERs, being told that my son could die. Now, you're right, that essay is kind of a riff on what to expect when you're expecting, when Molly is not a schoolgirl. And there is a lot of humor in addiction. It's not funny hearing that your son could die at any moment. Don't get me wrong. It's the worst possible thing to hear for a parent. But there is a lot of humor. And I found myself, you know, going back and forth constantly to psychologists. My son also saw the humor. I mean, he used to joke about raiding this adolescent psych hospitals, which is where they were often sent to see if they would be a risk to themselves and then held and then into going into inpatient treatment, that he used to joke that he would rate them on Yelp, which ones were better. And the first outpatient treatment program that we went to, on the way over, he started playing a playlist of, you know, the song about by Wax, I'm in Love with the Dispensary Girl, and Mary Jane, and Cocaine. And I don't know if I thought it was funny then, but I definitely, at some point when he was in recovery, a professional asked me, what are you doing for fun besides going to visit your son and going to Al-Anon? You should try stand-up or improv. You're funny. I know I don't sound very funny today, but so I tried stand-up, and that actually was, you know, part of that whole, my whole set was about addiction and also making fun of my own behavior as well. Because you do some really crazy things as the loved one of someone who's struggling with addiction.
Yeah.
And I write about that too. My behavior at some point probably looked crazier than the person who was using.
Yeah. I want to ask you, you alluded to it earlier, that you've done a lot of work with a group of incarcerated youths at a program titled Right Girl. Can you talk about that as far as what you've learned from that experience of teaching writing?
Yeah, so Right Girl is a wonderful program that matches writers with young women as mentors, but they also teach classes in schools and in what we call probation camps out here, which is basically a place for incarcerated youth. I have to say, most of the time going into the classrooms and teaching creative writing to these young women, they were eager to write about their lives, and they had an awful lot to write about. And it was really meaningful to them that somebody was actually listening to their work, and then later an anthology is published, so they get work published as well. And I think for some of them, that writing became a bit of a lifeline too, to you know, to have, and many of them expressed themselves very well. So it was really wonderful. I mentioned that there were times where it was really hard, where these young women would be going through something at the probation camp, and a teacher one time said, "Well, tell them why you're so upset." And they had gone in and done a raid to sort of drive home, you know, you have no rights, you're incarcerated, we have control over you. And they took all their toiletries and their journals, and they trashed them, basically. And so that day, the young women were sort of bouncing off the walls. But I really enjoyed it, and I hope to go back to doing that before too long.
All right. Well, the name of the book is One Day on the Gold Line. Carla Samuth, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Carla Rachel Samuth is a Southern Californian-based writing activist and writer. Her new collection of essays is titled One Day on the Gold Line, a memoir in essays. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.